But first, a conversation Terry recorded with Vince Vaughn in 2001. Vaughn has appeared in the films Clay Pigeons, Dodgeball, Anchorman, and Mr. and Mrs. Smith, among many others. He made his movie breakthrough in the independent film comedy Swingers, starring his friend Jon Favreau, who also wrote and directed the film. Vaughn and Favreau paired up again in the film Made. Favreau played an amateur boxer who needs money. He hooks up with his do-nothing friend, played by Vaughn, working for a mob boss in L.A. The job brings both of them into the unfamiliar world of money and guns. Favreau knows they're in over their heads, but Vaughn thinks he's cool enough to fake it, which of course keeps getting them deeper into trouble. Here they are on the way to their mission, flying first class for the first time. The flight attendant has just told Vaughn he can choose from a selection of videos.
What's the overhead on something like that? What's the action that's going to come my way for the videos?
The action that's going to come your way?
Yeah. What's it going to cost me for the videos?
No, you're up front. Everything's free up here.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. See that?
Yeah.
Oh, wait a minute. That, see now? They set you up and make it like everything's free when I drop this on you. And I bet there's a hidden tax where this is. Excuse me, sweetie.
Yes, excuse me.
Sorry. Where the drinks are concerned, is that a hidden tax? Does that fall under the complimentary upfront service as well, or is that something you pay for?
No, they're complimentary. Would you care for another one?
They're complimentary?
Yes.
You bet your ass I would. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Okay.
Thank you. Can I get a Cutty on the Rocks, too? Something a little stronger? Is that complimentary?
Yes.
Thank
yes.
You. Cheers, man. You hear that? Oh, everything yeah. Up here is free.
Okay.
A scene from the film Made. Terry asked Vince Vaughn to talk about it.
When John and I did Swingers, that was actually the very first time that I ever flew first class, going from Los Angeles to Venice for the film festival. And so when I was on first class, I was a bit overwhelmed by it. And I remember John being uncomfortable because I rang the bell and I asked some questions. But of course, you know, I didn't hit on the stewardess or flight attendant during that time.
What questions did you ask?
I was just like, are you this for free? And I said, you know, so if I want like, you know, a glass of champagne, that's free and I could get more glasses of champagne. She was like, yeah. I was like, are you serious? You know, and I couldn't believe it. I was like, now not only is there like one movie I can choose from, but you're saying that there's like a list of videos and I choose the video that I put in. I can watch any video that I want to watch. And I was just amazed that was happening. And Faz was kind of embarrassed, like, you know, act like you've been here before. And my point of view was, but I haven't been here before. Why should I cheat myself out of this first time experience, you know? So then as we took it, you know, Made in the movie with the mob, but Made as far as being an actor having an avenue in, we exaggerated it then for the comedy and also for who the characters were and what they had to serve for the overall story of the plot.
There's also first times in New York and a swank New York hotel. Did you have any of those first time experiences yourself where you maybe said something inappropriate or acted too overwhelmed by the riches?
Yeah, the biggest one that sticks out was, I remember that, so we do Jurassic Park, which was like, I went from like Swingers and did this other little film called The Locust, and I go to, which was a very small budget as well, to The Lost World, and I was just amazed by the toys and the amount of people that they had and the time that they had to shoot. And when that was over with, there's a thing called Toy Fair, which I'm familiar with because my dad is actually a toy salesman, but they made toys and stuff for Jurassic 3, and so now you go to Toy Fair, and they're sort of selling the toys to the buyers, which would be like Toys R Us or any of those franchises. And so they asked the actors to come, and like we had to come out like with lights and stuff like that and be a part of it and like meet the people and stuff. It was a very odd experience. And they said, you have $150, or I think, in incidentals, which means that, you know, the mini bar and, you know, the telephones included in that in this case and room service and that kind of stuff. So I thought it was like $150 for the 3 days I was there. So I was budgeting. And then I realized afterwards, because Jeff Goldblum was there, that it was actually $150 every night I could have spent in the room. But I was like budgeting and thinking that $150 had to go over the whole time. And I was just amazed by that number figure to be spent in a day on sort of pleasantries, you know.
Well, something similar happens to your character in Maid. He's told by Peter Falk, who's like the mob guy who's assigning them a job, he's told that they have a daily stipend, and your character thinks, oh, and what is that?
Right, the per diem.
The per diem, yeah.
First time I heard that was on Location, hired as an actor, and they said, I didn't know what the word per diem meant at all, and they said, this is your per diem. I just thought, like, boy, am I getting over on these guys who are giving me some cash money up front, you know.
You and Jon Favreau also start together in Swingers, which, like Maid, he wrote and directed. And in Swingers, you played somebody who was – he played somebody who was very naive and is reluctantly led into Vegas by you. Because he's broken up with his girlfriend, and you think Vegas is just what he needs.
Yeah, exactly.
And you're really arrogant and really faking it with a lot of flair in this movie. Let me play a short scene. This scene, this is your first time at one of the casinos with Jon Favreau's character, and you're demonstrating to him how to pick up a cocktail waitress at the casino.
Right. I walked around for an hour with that stupid scotch on my track.
Yeah, you got knocked out pretty fast.
Oh, a couple of high rollers like yourself.
Can you believe it?
I'll go get you that scotch.
You know, forget about it. I didn't even want it. I just wanted to order it.
Well, can I get you something else? I mean, you really shouldn't leave here without getting something for free.
Why ruin a perfect night? Listen, bring a single malted Glengarry for me and one for my boy Mikey here. And if you tell the bartender to go easy on the water, then this 50-cent piece has your name written all over it. Okay? I want you to run along because I'll be timing you. I'm going to keep time. 1, 2, 3, 4. What an ass. Baby, that was money. Tell me that wasn't money.
That was so demeaning.
She smiled, baby.
I can't believe what an ass you are.
No, no, baby, she smiled.
She was smiling what an ass.
No, she was smiling at how money I was, what I did with her.
Could we get out of here all right? Because I'm not going to pay for a room.
Mike, what the hell do you want to get out of here for? The honey baby's bringing us a cocktail.
What are you,
now.
Nuts? You think she's coming back here?
Baby, I know she's coming back here. Did you even hear what she said? You shouldn't leave without getting something for free. Baby, she wants to party. She wants to.
Vince Vaughn, in this scene, we heard one of the catchphrases that you became well-known for after Swingers, which was, you're so money, or that was so money. That's a phrase that you came up with for the film?
Sort of. I mean, it's sort of a Frankenstein, that phrase, because money existed in sort of a sports culture or hip-hop culture, but sort of going, you're so money, and or you're so money you don't even know it. It was sort of the phrase that caught on, which was the you don't even know it, and you're so is sort of what I added to it. And I used to say that a lot, half-jokingly, with John when we were friends. And you know, Swingers was based on a real-life experience in that he did break up with his girlfriend in order to move out after he filmed Rudy to pursue acting, and he was really kind of, you know, in a bad way about it. And I sort of, you know, took him out, and the places that I took him was the Dresden and the Derby, and I was sort of into swing music in that lounge scene. And of course, you know, John exaggerated for comedy's sake. We always look at comedy sort of an overcommitment to the ridiculous. So the fact that, you know, Trent would say this and believe it so much and sort of spin it as if this was the ultimate truth and you had to get this down is, to me, kind of pathetic. I was always sort of surprised that Trent was perceived as cool.
Were there people who thought that your character was so cool in the movie they tried to emulate you?
I've heard that, yeah. I've had people come up and say, well, boy, I'm the Trent in my group or this. And I just always thought it was funny because I always just thought, like, you know, these guys, I mean, you look at the movie, we're like playing video games, you know. It's not like the only girl I think Trent ever goes home with is the waitress, and it doesn't really work out with him. They go in the back and knock some stuffed animals off the couch, and that's about it. And then it gets interrupted, you know. But I think that Trent had a real innocence to him. You know, he's not maniacal or manipulative, but not from a complete understanding of what he's doing. I think he's very innocent. I think a lot of men, young men at that age, it's just sort of the thing of, it's such a big deal in a way. I think it shows women is very powerful because all this time and all this attention is spent on sort of how do we communicate with the opposite sex. So in a way, I think it really shows the power that women have, especially where men are concerned, because their whole lives are sort of dictated around, you know, how to connect or talk or communicate with women.
Swingers was really the movie in which you were noticed. What was your life like when you were working on Swingers with Jon Favreau?
Well, it was, you know, very much in the moment at the time, meaning there was no plan of anything. You know, we did the movie for $250,000 in like 21 days, so it was completely off the radar. And part of the reason we were able to do it so cheaply is a lot of it was illegal. We didn't get all the permits and things that you'd need if you were a larger movie that was being tracked or on the radar. A lot of the places that we shot at did us favors because we knew the owners, and they let us shoot there for free. And it actually, you know, gave the movie a great feel that it felt very authentic, that these were the people that would be at those places, and it brought a real energy that worked for the movie. But it came from a place of economics, of that was the only way we could get the movie done, and in a way that really served it and made the movie better. And making of Swingers, honestly, Terry, I was just looking to get tape to get an agent. I didn't have an agent at the time. I mean, I didn't know what would come of the thing. You know, we were putting this thing together, and we had read the screenplay for a year, trying to get it set up so it was like a play. We were able to go and shoot and get it, make our days very quickly because we all knew our stuff very well. But, you know, there was always a hope or a dream that it could get bought or that it could be seen, but the odds were just so against it. And we were lucky in that we did what we wanted to do and what we thought we found funny and sort of true for what our life experience was. You know, we didn't portray in that movie ourselves out to be, you know, street guys or, you know, really overly successful with girls or dealing with heavy problems of drugs and stuff like that, because that wasn't our experience. We were really out-of-work actors playing video games who liked girls and were sort of trying to figure out what was the best way to meet girls. And I think by being simple and telling the story, not having things go good in Vegas, I think it became something that was somewhat universal and a lot of people could relate to.
Vince Vaughn speaking with Terry Gross in 2001. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2001 interview with actor Vince Vaughn.
I want to ask you about another role that you played, and this was in the movie Clay Pigeons. Mm-hmm. This is one of two movies that you starred in with Joaquin Phoenix. And in this film, mm-hmm. you play a cowboy who's very glib, who it turns out he's a con artist and not to mention a serial killer. mm-hmm. How did you envision the part?
Well, I saw it as to make it not so serious and have it be sort of funny and not take it so serious so that it could come off like a bad HBO movie. And I was fascinated by the response to Trent to some degree, and I thought, well, can you play someone who's killing people in a way that has all these what's considered to be pleasant social graces and still have him be liked by people? Give him a point of view and some sort of, you know, really messed up code that somehow he followed. Go on that journey with sort of this guy who, how he perceived himself and all these sort of things. And I guess I've always been more drawn and fascinated to those kind of characters because I find it more interesting. And also it's sort of my life experiences are people that I knew. I mean, I would go to the racetrack as a little kid. My dad would take me all the time. And a lot of the people that I met were colorful people, interesting people. And a lot of them, you know, good people, but hustlers, you know. But with my dad being a salesman and sort of the people that I met, I was always really just sort of fascinated by that mindset.
Well, in this scene from Clay Pigeons, you're at a bar, you've just walked in, and you're trying to pick up a character played by Janine Garofalo. And there are, as you mentioned, kind of traces of your character, Trent from Swingers, in your approach here. Let's hear it.
Damn! Good-looking girl. Drinks Johnny Walker Black. Even pays with her own money. I can't wait to start dreaming nice.
You're very colorful.
Oh, you don't know the half of it. I'm like a big fireworks show. But very bright. Like light bright.
You know what? No offense, but this seat is saved.
Who for?
First guy not wearing denim.
You're not from around here, are you?
What makes you say that?
Well, you don't look like the town much. You don't. My name's Lloyd. I won't bite you.
That's a plus, Lloyd.
That's a scene from Clay Pigeons. Vince Vaughn, do you want to say anything about that scene?
Just that, you know, that was my favorite scenes in the movie was with Janine Garofalo. I think she's incredible. And some of that was improvised, and she's just so great and so available. It was really very easy to respond off of her. I mean, I knew I had the burden of Janine, who's a very bright, sophisticated person, although she's playing this character and she knows ultimately that she has to give in to me because that's, you know, the script and sort of where we need to take it for the movie. So she's open to that. So my job's a little easier, but I knew it had to come off believable that you bought, that I made her laugh or that I got her to be open to talking to me. And so, you know, I went in there with a real specific point of view and really the biggest thing with those kind of things are listening and really paying attention to her movement and her talking and seeing what, you know, what was the way in to this particular person.
You grew up in Minnesota. Would you describe the neighborhood that you were from?
Well, I didn't really grow up in Minnesota. I was born outside of Minneapolis.
You grew up in Chicago, right.
I lived there for about a month. My dad was a salesman for Swift Meat Company, and he was transferred. I lived in Minnesota for 1 month, and I was raised in Buffalo Grove, which is sort of a middle-class suburb in Illinois. And I lived there till I was 8, and then I moved to Lake Forest, Illinois, which is an upper-class suburb of Illinois. And I lived there until I was 18 and graduated.
Were your parents moving up financially when you moved up to a better
My dad was. Yeah, my dad was. My dad was a very driven man in that, you know, he grew up not very well off or well-to-do and, you know, sort of self-motivated and put himself through college, used to work in a factory in the summer to, you know, pay for college and that and got a job right away working sales for Swift's Meats and then got transferred and around and moved up and did very well. And then he became, and then moved, switched over to the toy industry. So then he opened up his own company when we moved to Lake Forest. And it was a big deal, I think, for my mom and that who grew up sort of blue collar as well, to sort of give us kids a better education opportunity than what they had. A big part of the reason for us moving there was because of the schools and the academics, which is sort of funny. I became an actor and I never went to college.
Now, I read that you were in a class with problem kids. Is that correct?
Yeah, you know, well, the thing, as time has gone on, people have learned more, but I went into a class one period a day. They would make me go to a classroom with, you know, maybe 10 or 12 other students, all who had no obvious sort of retardation or anything, but it was more learning disabilities.
Mm.
But for me, it was like, you know, and I sort of felt like McMurphy in Cuckoo's Nest, and I've said that before, and that you'd have the tallest girl in the whole school. She would never talk. She'd never raise her hand in class. But, you know, you sort of look at that and say, well, this girl's already sticking out in a sort of way. Maybe she doesn't feel like raising her hand, you know. And I think most of the people there had more to do with sort of an emotional position based on a physical thing. Chuck Suitmeyer was in the thing, and his parents were still farmers, and he dressed differently than everybody else. So that probably had more to do with it than anything else. But we would go, and it was embarrassing because you'd be 10 years old, and you'd go for one period a day, and they'd make you play Candyland. And everyone in the school knew you were going to this classroom. So as you're struggling to have a social life, that was definitely something that was a hindrance. But it was really a gift for me. I mean, in a way, it made me be, I think, more outspoken and that sort of thing in order to have friends. And I was always very popular and well-liked, not just by one group, but I think by most of the kids in my school growing up. And I felt a need to sort of counter that by, I think, being funny and having a sense of humor and maybe being a bit confrontational with teachers and that sort of thing. And when I first went into the class, I was very kind of mean to the other kids, and I felt like, I don't belong here. These kids are, you know, these kids are crazy. I don't belong here with these kids. And then that kind of grew into me feeling very connected to them and very protective of them and, you know, going out of my way to try to include them and, you know, whether we were playing kickball at recess or whatever, I would go and, you know, pick them for my team, and I felt very including of them after a while.
What was your learning disability?
I don't know. I don't know what it was. I think I just had a short attention span, and I think everyone learns differently. I mean, I was in all normal classes. It was just that, you know, certain kids who they felt like needed one class a day to go, but it was not like the class was effective. There was nothing that was done there. It was just a place to put these kids. You know, and all the other people that were in the class were all fine and very capable people. And I think probably had more to do with a family home experience or a physical thing in school or maybe, you know, a dyslexia that was, you know, better understood now today than it was in the early 70s. Sort of the thing to do then was sort of throw Ritalin at it, you know.
Yeah, were you ever treated with Ritalin?
They said that they wanted to put me on Ritalin. My mom gave it to me one time. And I reacted badly to it. And then both my parents, my dad, said, you know, there's no way my son's going to go through life doped up. There's just, you know, how can he process or learn anything or mature or grow if he's not, doesn't have his senses about him, you know? He's not going to be able to process things. I was lucky that my parents were, you know, had that sort of vision. A lot of parents went through it, I think, with their kids. But, you know, when the school's telling you it's the right thing and it's helping them, like, you know, it's hard to say that they did bad. But my parents, I was fortunate enough, knew that that wasn't the right thing.
Vince Vaughn speaking with Terry Gross in 2001. He's starring with Owen Wilson in the new movie Wedding Crashers.